Okay, thank you very much. So I will talk about the feasibility of side channel attacks with brain computer interfaces, consumer grade PCI devices that are on the market, came to the market last couple of years and are starting to be part of all kinds of gaming environments. So this is a joint work. This is a joint work with my colleagues, Doug Davis, Mario Frank, Daniele Perito, and Don Song from UC Berkeley, and Thomas Roche from Department of Fundamental Neurosciences from University of Geneva. So my talk is divided into two parts. In the first part, I will give a brief introduction to BCI and EEG and all these ingredients that we need for our experiments. And then in the second part, I will focus on our security related work. So in the last decades, BCI devices have been primarily applied in the medical domain to enable a non-muscular communication between a user and the external device by measuring brain activities. Usually there are four different steps. There is signal acquisition, when the user performs a certain task that produces a certain EEG signature or signature in the brain activities. Then there is extraction of these features, where we get them from the EEG signal. And then we translate them into, for example, certain tasks, such as movement of a robot arm or a message that is displayed on the screen. Now, I said brain waves. What are the brain waves? Well, the brain waves reflect brain's electrical activity, and most BCIs are based on EEG, since it provides kind of a simple and non-invasive method for recording these electrical fields, which are directly produced by neuronal activities. So whenever a neuron is active, there is a brief voltage change. You can see that on the left figure. That actually, and this voltage change can be even more than 100 millivolts. But whenever we talk about EEG, we talk about synchronous activity of millions of neurons firing at the same time, meaning at the same frequencies. Now, when you look at this EEG, which is on the right figure, then on the horizontal line, you will see time. And we can say that EEG provides a high temporal resolution and let us capture brain dynamics on a millisecond scale. On the other hand, the horizontal, I was talking about the horizontal, now about the vertical, is at the sampling points, at the positions of the electrodes that we place on our head. And this is a poor spatial resolution then. So this is why the medical clinical grade EEG devices look like simply to increase the number of sampling points. And so that EEG signal is recorded from these scalp electrodes and then captured by a differential amplifier, which then tries to increase the signal to noise ratio of the electrical signal that is significantly attenuated by the scalp. Okay. So they are very expensive devices, and as I mentioned, they are used for decades in a medical domain. Now, before we can do something with the signal, there is another problem that EEG signal is full of different artifacts which are recorded by EEG they arise from different sources other than brain activity. So for example, we even capture power lines, 50 or 60 hertz, Europe or US. We can see muscular artifacts such as lifting eyebrows, closing jaw, eye movements, eye blinks. It's all captured by these devices. So before we can get to a clear signal, we need to do some signal pre-processing. But once we are finished with that. There are different kinds, different patterns of brain waves that can actually help us to differential different neurological neurocognitive states, and they offer us a rich feature space for studying all kinds of neurological processes for their users. So for example, looking at certain frequencies, there is alpha bands, which are between 8 hertz and 12 hertz. Usually increased activity in that bands reflects when the user, when the subject is in a relaxed meditative state. Beta, in contrast, is when the user has active concentration, anxious thinking, or is in a state of alertness. So basically by just, now this is all still ongoing research from a neuroscience perspective, and there is still not a clear and complete mapping. But there are certain results that can nowadays be used and that are used in diagnosis or in helping people with, for example, children with attention deficits and so on. So they can even be used to learn how to increase your attention, to train your attention, or to help you learn how to relax by, for example, being able to train to increase alpha activities. Okay. So another interesting phenomena that we are going to use that we have used for our work is so-called event-related potentials. Now, in contrast to previous slide where I have shown so-called continuous or running EEGs, this neurophysiological phenomenon is actually seen as a response to certain stimulus. So it's a time-locked. There is a certain pattern of voltage change after an auditory or visual stimulus is presented to a subject. So, as I mentioned, it is time locked to the stimulus. That means that the time frame at which we can we expect it to happen is actually known in advance, given that the timing of the stimulus is known. So, for example, in the first figure here, you can see at the time zero, the stimulus was shown, and then after it, there are certain event-related potentials that occur. One particular and very prominent event is so-called P300. It happens, it has an amplitude peak around 300 milliseconds. It is especially interesting because it is associated with recognition and classification of external stimuli. It has been observed to also be elicited during stimuli that are personally meaningful to participants, to subjects. So whenever we are, for example, in a certain classification task where we have to choose between stimuli that are important for the task and so-called relevant stimuli and non-relevant, then we can expect P300 to be detected in this task. So one particular application is a P300 speller where, for example, patients with, for example, Loken syndrome can actually spell and communicate where they are flashed with the different symbols, and by focusing their attention on a particular symbol, they are able actually to spell a message or a command. And now in the last couple of years, there is a whole bunch of consumer-grade PCI devices coming to market, and there are intended for general public. Different companies offer low-cost EEG devices, and even more, they offer software development kits to support expansion of these tools. So you can actually write your own games and then put them on their application market, like a typical app market from smartphones and so on. So by looking, for example, at this company, it's Emotive, it's very popular. They offer a cheap PCI, EEG-based PCI device for $300. You can get for a thousand, you can get a research license where you get an API which provides you access to raw EEG data. It has a mobile phone support, wireless USB, so it's quite usable. And what you can see here is their application market, where you can actually go and download these all kinds of little games, ranging from accessibility tools such as mind-controlled keyboard, mind-controlled mouse, hands-free arcade games, to so-called serious games, that is, games with a purpose other than pure entertainment, such as attention training, neurofeedback, memory training games, and so on. So similarly to them, there is also Neurasky, another popular company, using a bit different technology, but it's also based on EEG. User package here is $200. Again, we have API access to raw EEG data. There is application market, again, mobile phone support, wireless USB, very similar, and similar to emotive, all kinds of applications from, again, mind control games, interfaces to connect BCI device with a conventional PC game, neurofeedback, even music composition you can try to do using your mind. So all kinds of things. I will not go in discussion, okay, how much of that really works. For some, it works better. For some less. But for us, there is a clear motivation. As security researchers, motivation is that we have users, naive users, that like to put strange-looking devices on their heads. And so in the next part of my talk, I will talk about these security-related problems that we worked on. So let me define threat model. We will consider computer and the BCI devices trusted, but the third-party BCI applications are not. So in this case, let's assume we have a malicious developer who can, of course, access raw EEG signals. It can manipulate screen content, so it can present all kinds of stimuli to a user. And of course, good old social engineering techniques that he will try to engage a user into playing some kind of a mind games. So our attacker will attempt to infer secret and private information from the user by detecting, in this case, whether certain stimuli are recognized and personally meaningful, as personally meaningful to the user. Okay, a few words about hardware we used. We have used a Motive Epoch device. It is on the market for at least 3-4 years. We have a research, we bought a research license to get access to raw EEG. This device has 14 channels, 128 hertz sampling rate. Now there are different problems with, we encountered on this way. One is that this device is not optimized for detecting this event-related potentials, but it's more optimized for detecting facial expressions, so facial recognition, if you smile, blink, and so on. This can be seen here that actually the this so-called this P300 event-related potential, which we think could help us to find out what are the meaningful information for the user, is positioned between top and back of our head. On the other hand, what you see here is the position of the electrodes on the head from a motive. So most of the electrodes are on the frontal part, as I said, mostly for detection of facial expressions. So now suddenly we're also going to have problems with all these kind of muscular movements, and the signal is quite noisy. Another potential problem is that something that we want to measure is actually below EEG noise level. So event-related potentials are somewhere between 1 and 10 microvolt, and EEG is between 20 and 50. So this will clearly result in, well, we have to do some signal processing. We have to increase the number of trials, do averaging, and I would say, for the exact methodology, please take a look at the paper. Another important problem here is we need to find out the correct recognition model. So how do we find out whether a user is recognizing something or not? So recognition model should be able to discriminate between targets, which is then information that is personal, that we would like to find out, and non-targets, meaning irrelevant information. So how to find the most discriminative features, which are actually the right configuration of channels, time offsets, which depend on a particular user. So what you see here, for example, is principal component analysis of different components from EEG signal. And here we could try to eliminate some components by looking at their location, but this would not be enough to have satisfying results. So what we had to do, we have these experiments consist of two phases. First phase is a training phase, where the targets are known. So we have this training phase to find out how the recognition really looks like in the EEG signal. So in this phase, subjects participate in a simple controlled experiment for which we know the outcome. Okay. And we will extract then the correct feature weights from that training data, and we will try to train the classifier and then go into the second phase, which is an online phase or the attack phase. Targets are unknown. We use a trained classifier, and we will use different experiments for different targets. I will show these experiments a bit later. So let's still stay a bit in the training phase. Training phase actually defines, describes the main trade-off, which is between obtrusiveness that we have in order to increase the user attention of the recognition during some kind of a classification task, and concealment, on the other hand, which we would like to have to avoid the discovery of attackers' true intentions. Okay, so we would like to keep it very low profile, but on the other hand, we will need to have some kind of attention from the user. So we have experimented with two different training strategies here. One training is an active training where the user is given a task that requires increased attention, such as counting. So for example, count the number of occurrences of the number six. Okay. So in this case, we got your attention because you have to concentrate to be able to count. And then there is another possibility which will increase, which will then increase more this concealment, where we call it passive training, where we don't put the user, user does not support the training phase, but of course he does not actively attempt to disturb it. So in this case, we just flash a question and then provide certain stimuli, and we choose stimuli such that we know which one can be recognized. Okay, so in this case, the question is, do you recognize any of these persons? And then suddenly we flash different pictures, and I assume that you recognize one person on these pictures. And basically, we made this experiment such that just that person could be recognized. All the others are some random people that we assume you don't know. Okay, so how does that look when we take a look in the signal? So these are the results of the training phase. So on the left figure, you can see the response to the target stimulus. So you can see there are certain features there. And on the right are non-targets. And so we will generate from this, we will generate a series of weights for different channels, different time offsets to emphasize such recognition, and then to limit all other signal features that we don't think will help us to detect recognition. Okay, so here is the big picture of the experimental setup. As I said, first we have the training stimuli, which we know. And after training phase, we suddenly start presenting new stimuli on the screen. For that, we've done some experiments. We recruited 30 computer science students. There was no deception, but we provided just minimal information. That means they knew a bit that it's a security-related research, but of course they didn't know what exactly is going to happen. Experiments lasted about 45 minutes per participant, and flashing sequence lasted about 90 seconds. So after flashing, We use, yeah, we done some signal processing, we trained the classifier, and then we wanted from the classifier the ranking, which stimuli are considered to be target. So not just one, but the ranking. And of course, we wanted to find out whether or not we are better than a pure random guessing without knowledge. Okay, so what experiments have we done? Well, many. One experiment was, what is the first digit of your PIN? And then we were flashing some numbers. I think even this could work. Let's see. Yeah, okay. Then where do you live after making sure that the participants are, these experiments were done in Berkeley, near the campus. We were flashing all kinds, little parts of the city. We asked, what is your preferred credit card, month of birth, preferred bank, do you know any of these people? So the people experiment again. And so these were the experiments. We also had some more, but these are probably the most interesting and the ones that also revealed some interesting information. So let me show you the results. What you can see here is cumulative statistics on the ranking of the correct answer according to the classification result. So the dash line shows a random guess. Then there is blue line, which is a passive user training, so trained just by showing pictures. Red and black are two different classifiers that we have tested, but basically there is no significant difference between classifiers. Okay, so let's take a look at how to read these figures. Let's for example see month of birth experiment. So the random guess has 50% chance to have the correct answer in the first six choices. I don't know if this works. So this is month of birth, and yeah. So 50% here, and we were actually able to find out the correct answer in the first six positions near 100%, meaning we actually decreased, we actually had an entropy reduction of nearly 50%. So our search space halved. All the experiments show that there is certain information leakage. Of course, you have to consider this is still very noisy data signal. Devices are not made for detecting these kinds of patterns, but yet it was possible to see that in any of these experiments we could actually perform better than a pure random guess. All right, so I'm coming to the end, so let me simply conclude this talk and say a few words about the future work. So yes, we have shown that PCI gaming devices intended for general public can be used as a potential side channel to infer secret and private information about the users. Well, it won't happen tomorrow, but there is a mutual objective of both users and an attacker, and that is signal will get better. Devices will get better, capture signal will get better, simply for the reasons that users will then enjoy better gaming experience, and of course, attacker will also have better signal to analyze. On the other hand, there are certain constraints that we have to keep, fulfill, based on this neural, based on the event-related potentials, where we have to keep the target versus non-target ratio high enough. So if we have too many potential information that the user will recognize as personally meaningful, then we will actually decrease the amplitude of this, for example, P300. So we have to take care how to design these experiments. There is, of course, then a main trade-off that I mentioned between intrusiveness and concealment. We would like to increase the attention because then, for example, if we ask the user to count, we have a really good signal. We will perform very well. But of course, counting is an active task that user could get suspicious. and clearly experiments tasks that are given influence what is target and non-target stimulus. So as a future work, there is question whether there are potentials for more sophisticated attacks. Can we embed these attacks into videos, online games? There is some ongoing work here. And of course, we can, as I mentioned, we can have better results by getting more support from social engineering techniques. For example, as I mentioned, let's say this first digit pin experiment, if you just ask the user, do you really think your pin is random? Count the number of occurrences. I mean, this is confusion for the user, but if he counts, we get a really good results. Okay, so let me conclude this talk. Thank you for your time and attention. And I think there is still some time for questions. Thank you very much.
Hi, Tamara Denning, University of Washington. So I have a question that you sort of briefly addressed on one of your last slides there about, given your threat model, the threat model that you're giving of someone gaming in their living room, what your thinking was behind setting up the experiments that you did? Because it seems like you showed, yes, the P300, you know, does work, which is somewhat already known in the literature. So I was just wondering why you didn't go ahead and explore from the beginning some more concealed ways of extracting information.
Yes, I mean, just getting this P300, and basically we can't really say it's about P300. It's some kind of the recognition, and the P300 was more about this kind of binary classification task.
Right, when you're actively asking someone to
engage. Yeah, and he really wanted to know. So there are some details where, for example, just finding out about this problem of hiding this training phase. Where we just simply present pictures and then use that as a training for some other experiments. This was something that we wanted to find out. This was just the first step. I think we've done some initial experiments on more sophisticated attacks, but at the moment, for this you need a user study, you need ethical review, it still takes some time to really show these results.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Peter Neumann, SRI, obvious question. Have you thought about using this particular approach to combat the rubber hose free approach of the previous paper?
Yeah, so I think there are papers on detecting some kind of coercion attacks. So I don't know, maybe you can point me to it.
Yeah. Hi.
Yeah, so we were more from the attacker perspective here.
Luke Desitelles from the University of Louisiana. As gesture recognition technology improves, stuff like the Kinect and the acuity of cameras increases, do you think that will also be at risk to these sort of attacks? I could show you several different pictures. Which one of these people do you know? The first one I look at, suddenly I've given away more information than I intended. Yeah. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, true. I mean, gaze tracking, for example, would probably reveal some information. On the other hand, here we are interested in subconscious responses. So for example, there are some neuroscientific research which shows that even if you try to lie, you will actually need more attention, and this will produce a better signal for us to detect. So I think gaze tracking is more on the conscious part of the level. While probably there are certain saccades, fixation points in eye behavior that we could use, but still I think in this work we really interested in something where the user cannot really hide.
Paul Miller, Microsoft Corporation. Since you said the devices are really optimized towards picking up facial expressions, are you actually seeing emotional response showing into facial expressions in the classifier that you're developing here?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So yes, we wanted to know a little bit more about that. So actually we saw that the weights in the classifier are more into the part of our back of our head where we would expect, for example, P300 to occur. So the classifier actually limited the influence of the frontal electrodes. So that gives some kind of indication that it's not really facial expression. But I mean, from the attacker's perspective, whatever it is that reveals information will be fine.
Okay. So I have a question. Have you looked at designs for lie detector tests? I mean, this is sort of equivalent in the sense that whatever you would ask somebody taking a test like that, you could ask here kind of similar questions.
Yes, correct. So P300 has been considered in kind of new generation of lie detectors, so-called guilty knowledge tests. We have addressed that in the paper. Simply for time constraints, I have now put many of related work that is actually that inspired us here. But it's a little bit different threat model here. You know, in lie detection, we have interrogator who completely controls the BCI, high quality equipment. On the other hand, also interrogated person knows it's been interrogated. Here, the user usually, well, the goal is that the user doesn't know that. So there are certain differences. But true, guilty knowledge test is, well, probably that's the most related, the most directly related work on this topic.